Okay. The title of this shiur is, it's a brand new topic. We have studied Sefer Yonah at least twice before, textually, meaning going from the beginning to the end, going through all the nuances of the Sefer. I think both times we elided or very quickly did Perek Bet. And along the way, if you recall, and even if you don't recall, along the way, we asked a whole lot of questions about the story that, and I put kind of as a cute little thing as the nod to Ira Gershwin here, that made the story kind of difficult. And what I did, and this is absolutely unprecedented, we never do this, Jason could testify as far as what the notes look like, that you have the whole, almost the whole first page is actually an English overview or outline of what the issues are. But there are a whole lot of issues, and I want to talk about them, about Sefer Yonah, that makes Sefer Yonah very difficult, Sefer to read. Meaning, you read it in the context of Tanakh, and it doesn't make sense. And I'll just list some of the major issues. And my nod to Ira Gershwin, if as long as you guys got it, was from, okay, Porgy and Bess, right? It ain't necessarily so, right? Jonah got it by a whale, right? I don't know about you. I have zero problems whatsoever believing that a fish could be big enough and could swallow a person, and the person could live in the fish for 3 days, and a person can close a tefillah. That's all fine. That's a nace. That's simply a nace. Clearly, it's something that doesn't occur in, shall we say, everyday events, but I got no problem with that. But I do have a problem with a whole series of things in the book. And let's start from the beginning. God sends Yonah, a Navi, as far as we know from Shevet Zvulun, at least he lives in the territory of Zvulun. We know that from the one mention of him outside of Sefer Yonah, which is in Sefer Malachim Bet, Perek Yudalad, Pasuk Chafhei. And he sends him to go to Nineveh and to make a cry against Nineveh. We're not told what that cry is. We're just told that he's supposed to go preach to Nineveh. Now, this is unprecedented and unmatched. Unprecedented before, unmatched since, for Hashem to send a Navi to a non-Jewish nation. Is that true? No, it's not true. Hashem does send Nevi'im to non-Jewish nations, but that's a little different. The main one, of course, that we could think of is Mitzrayim. Hashem sends Moshe to Paro. But that's different because Hashem is sending Moshe to Paro in order to free Am Yisrael. In other words, it's in our interest. Hashem does not send Nevi'im to the foreign nations. Now, before moving away from that problem, I'll point something else out. We have a number of prophecies. Yeshayahu, Yudalad through Chafet, Amos, Aleph and Bet, and other passages in Amos, passages towards the end of Yirmiyahu, passages in Yechezkel, where the Navi gives prophecy against the nations. So in the nations, you're going to suffer this way, and you're going to be punished for what you did to Am Yisrael, for what you did to each other, or whatever it may be. However, those prophecies, as far as we can tell, are delivered within the Jewish audience. And it's what we refer to as a feigned audience. It's a rhetorical tool where you get up and you speak as if you're talking to a different audience, but you're really talking to the audience that's here and say, this is what I'm communicating about them. Think about what that means for you. To actually send a Navi to a foreign nation in order to speak to the foreign ruler and the foreign people in order to get them to change their ways, never heard of before, never heard of since. So, of course, you could have an unprecedented thing, and that's Yonah. Fine, you could say that's the one counterexample, perhaps. The problem is who he sends them to. He sends Yonah, in this case, not to some Cush, to take a piece out of Amos, to some foreign nation far away that's got nothing to do with Am Yisrael. He sends it to Ashur. And the timing couldn't be stranger, because we don't have any time frame for Sefer Yonah itself. But the person, Yonah, mentioned in Sefer Malachim, operates during the middle of the 8th century BCE, because he operates during the reign of Yeravam ben Yoash, who became king in about 780-something BCE, and reigned for a long time. And so he's in the 4th or 5th decade of the 8th century BCE. 30 years later, Ashur is going to come and cause what is likely the worst disaster in the history of the Jewish people. He destroys Malchut Yisrael, and with it takes over 50% of the Jewish people captive, never heard from since. Think about that in terms even of the Shoah, and it's hard to find something which had as big of an impact, utterly changed Am Yisrael, but it's so far back in history, we don't think of it that way. So this is Ashur, Assyria. Now, I'm aware of the Abarbanel's approach. The Abarbanel explains as follows. He says, well, God can't, and I'm always uncomfortable with those two words being together. God can't let Assyria live if they don't do tshuva. But if they don't live, then he can't use Assyria to be his rod of anger against Am Yisrael. So therefore, he needs Yonah to get Assyria to do tshuva so they can be saved, so they can go destroy Am Yisrael. You think about how troubling that thinking is, and in all sorts of ways. So that's part one, the agency itself. Part two is Yonah's reaction to the agency. We do have Nevi'im who refuse, or shall we say try to refuse, or shall we say hesitate, their mission. Most famously, of course, Moshe. But of course, there's Yirmiyahu, and seemingly Amos, who doesn't seem to want it, who never planned to go but was sent, Yishayahu doesn't want to go, I'm Tameh, I'm Potoch, I'm Tameh Sfataim, etc. Okay, all understood. But to actually run away from God? Now remember, we're talking about a Navi, which means this is somebody of great spiritual stature and intellectual stature and everything else. And what he's running away from God. And what does that mean to run away from God? And he admits as such when on the boat, when the sailors interrogate him, he says, yes, I am the one, I am devoted to Hashem, Elohei Hashemayim v'Elohei Haaretz, who created the dry land and the sea. So it's like he admits there's no way to run away from God. So what's he running away from? So yes, there is the position that's maybe associated with the Kuzari's brand of thinking, which is he's trying to run away from getting the prophecy because you can't get a prophecy in Chutz Laaretz. But of course, that's difficult on about three levels. Level one is that, well, he's supposed to go to Nineveh, which is also Chutz Laaretz. So what's it to Nineveh and the sea? Either way, he's going somewhere where he theoretically wouldn't get the word. Second of all, it's not true. After all, the greatest of Nevi'im had almost all of his Nevuot, perhaps all of his Nevuot, outside of Israel. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. And Yechezkel, all the whole book of Yechezkel is composed outside of Israel. So there is Nevuah outside of Israel. So you want to say, Hayo, Haya, and he got Nevuah in Babel because he originally had in Israel, the Gemara about Yechezkel. Fine, then the same thing applies here. Yonah already got his Nevuah in Israel, so it would continue. The whole notion of Yonah running away is very difficult. That's number two. Number three is Yonah's on the boat, and Yonah acts like the most despicable of characters on the boat. And by the way, the pagan sailors, and we talked about this every time we learned it, the pagan sailors behave like heroes. They daven, each to their own god. In the meantime, they also take the practical method of throwing cargo off, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, but they try to act to save the boat. And they look around, and they finally do a lottery, and the lottery points to Yonah. And here's this guy who booked passage on a freighter and just went to sleep, and all hell is breaking loose, and he's still sleeping. They wake him up, and they say, what's going on? And because the lottery pointed to him, and he says, yes, I'm running away from God, and he created everything. I mean, these guys have every right at this point to kill him or to force him at knife point to do tshuva or something. Instead, they say, what can we do? I mean, they're super nice. And finally, he says, throw me overboard and it'll be quiet. Now, Yonah at this point I think it's a simple thing, should say, you know what? I did wrong. I got to do. I can't risk them. So he should say to God, okay, send it in Nineveh. Get me to safe port. Or else, at the very worst, if he refuses, jump off the boat. But to say, you're going to have to throw me off the boat, is just, it's very bizarre. So that's problem three. Problem four is Yonah then gets a second chance. He goes to Nineveh. He walks into this huge town and he gives a geshri. But what's the geshri? What does he say? He says, Od arba'im yom v'Nineveh nepachet. A five-word prophecy. That's it. In 40 days, Nineveh will be destroyed. That's all he says. I want you to imagine you're in Nineveh. Nineveh is New York or Beijing, or I don't know, it's some huge capital center of the world's economy and commerce and cosmopolitan town. And some guy comes in and he's probably not smelling that well because you just got out of 3 days in a fish. He's a foreigner. He walks into town and he broadcasts a message: in 40 days, Nineveh will be destroyed. What would you do if you were a member of Nineveh? You'd probably call out the guys with the butterfly nets. Or maybe you'd imprison him or probably beat him up as some sort of a rabble rouser. Instead, what happens? Everybody hears it and their immediate reaction is to go into tshuva mode. Now, by the way, notice that his message, in 40 days, Nineveh will be destroyed, that's the translation, doesn't say who's going to destroy it, doesn't say why it's going to be destroyed, and perhaps most significantly, doesn't say what you can do to avert it or can be averted. In the meantime, everybody goes into tshuva mode immediately. And the word reaches the king. Now, you're the king of Assyria, the emperor of Assyria, sitting in your palace in Nineveh, and you hear that some Jewish guy showed up and started giving you such a geshri. What would you do? I have him locked up, or else ignore it. Instead, the king gets off his throne, sits on the ground, sackcloth and ashes, puts out a royal edict, which is that nobody may eat or drink, including the children, including the animals. Pretty weird. And everybody should call out, including the animals, call out to God. What does that mean for animals to call out to God? And to return all of the stolen items that they have to the rightful owners, and maybe God will have compassion. How bizarre can you get? First of all, the reaction to be so accepting of this prophetic message, it puts Yonah at the forefront of the Prophet's Hall of Fame. By the way, the Prophet's Hall of Fame is an empty building because Nevi'im are 99.9% fail at their mission. Because if their mission is to get people to change, read through. It doesn't work. Their mission, like you see at the beginning of Yechezkel, is to broadcast the word. And the word was broadcast, even though they're not going to succeed. But how many Nevi'im actually got the people they were talking to change the way that they behaved? And yet Yonah, boom, like that, gets it all done. That's first of all. Second of all, how do they know all of this? How do they know that it's God who's going to do this? How do they know what it is that God's angry about and why he's going to do it? And how do they know it can be averted and what they can do to avert it? And they seem to do it right because God then backs off. Now, Yonah at that point, of course, should be pretty happy. Did a very quick job and great success rate. Instead, Yonah is so upset that he says to God he wants to die. And then there's the whole story with the tree and the shade. So we have all sorts of bizarre things going on in this book, which is why it's a difficult book to read. Meaning almost every major component of this story is the exact opposite of Tanakh. You have a Navi sent to the non-Jewish nation, opposite of Tanakh. You have a Navi actually run away from God, never heard of in Tanakh. You have a Navi who comes into the city and gives a message, and immediately everybody falls to their feet and accepts the message and does their own proper interpretation of the message and acts on it. Never heard of before. You don't have such a thing before. The only time you have that is when something fearful is happening and the Navim perhaps speaks at the right exact moment so people will react temporarily, like Eliyahu and Har Carmel. But afterwards, it falls apart. Here, it's there's nothing fearful happening. It's just words. And they all accept it. And then, for the Navi to express the intent, I wish I could die, take my life. Now, there is another Navi who said that, and that's Eliyahu. And Eliyahu says it from a very different perspective. He feels abandoned. Yonah was just supported. He's like a popular guy in this foreign town. And yet, Yonah wants to die. It's very strange. So the whole story is weird. And we've talked about this in the past, and I suggested, following sort of the direction of the Vilna Gaon, that to understand the book as a mashal, and that what it is a mashal of essentially truth versus compassion. And we hear from the very beginning of the book, Yonah is Yonah ben Amitai, son of truth. And when Yonah, and you take a look at it in source one, when Yonah brings his argument to God. After God forgave Nineveh, Yonah says, "Vaypala Adonai vayomar ana Adonai halo zed dvari al adheyoti al admati al ken kidamti dvarach tashisha." It's because you forgave the people, that's why I ran away. I knew you'd forgive them. Why? Ki adati ki ata Adonai el chanun v'rachum erach apayim v'rav chesed v'nicham al ra'at. Because I know that you're forgiving and you're compassionate and you will tear up a bad decree. Beautiful. What's wrong with that? Notice, compare it with the original version of the Midot HaRachamim, which this is the season of that. Now we'll take a look in source 2. Ravo Adonai Panav Eikra, Adonai Adonai El Rachum Chanun Erech Apayim Rav Chesed Ve'emet. And that's the one that Yonah leaves out. So the direction that we talked about here was that Yonah is essentially demanding absolute integrity in tshuva. God, you cannot forgive people just because they get scared and they go into panic mode and they make whatever oaths they make and they give up whatever they give up. You need absolute integrity here. And you don't have it, so therefore you shouldn't forgive them. And God says, yes, I do. And of course, the interesting thing is what happens at the end of the book. Because at the end of that, and what happens at the end of the book is somewhat inscrutable. Yonah goes east of the city and he watches what happens in the city. And God then has this tree grow up and the tree grows over Yonah and gives him shade and he's very happy. And then God appoints a worm and the worm eats into the tree. And in the morning, the tree is dry, so the leaves have all fallen off. There's no more shade. And then God sends a Santana to the hot wind, and it blows, and Yonah again wants to die, and God then gives him the message. Last two psukim. You had compassion over a tree. This tree was here for one day. It was growing in the afternoon, and by the next morning it was gone. I shouldn't have compassion for Nineveh. So he's recording here a population of 1,200,000 people. Whatever Benyamin Olismolo might mean, many cattle. The idea is that I have all these people, they're my creatures, I shouldn't have compassion for them. Now, what's great about being Hashem is you're always getting the last word. God gets in the last word in this argument, and God's last word is chesed beats emet. Okay, beautiful story. So question asked, question answered. Question asked, which is, how do we explain all of the bizarre things that seem to be the opposite of Tanakh in this book? And the answer is that the story is there really to teach a lesson. Meaning it's not the story is not, shall we say, the framework around which great prophetic words are said, but it's there to teach a lesson. Okay, very nice. But now we'll come to the new question. That's old stuff. That's just a review. Here's the question that has been bothering me for years and I never really had an answer to. What is Sefer Yonah doing in Tanakh? What is Sefer Yonah doing in Tanakh? Now you can ask that about a number of different books. The question has been asked about Esther. And the question could be asked about, depending on your perspective on Tanakh, could be asked about Shir HaShirim. But I think asking the question about Yonah really is very much in place. Just think about it. Yonah is one of the 12 what are called minor prophets, which means books of Nevuah, which are very short. And they were collected together, Chazal say, because they were so short that if they were left separate, they'd be lost. So I put them together to kind of preserve them. Okay, what are the other 11? Hosea, Yoel, Amos, Ovadia, Micha, Nahum, Chavakuk, Tzifanya, Chagai, Zachariah, Malachi. You look through any of those 11, and what will you find? 90 to 100% of the items. What will you find there? What will you find? Yeah, so Jason, hold on a second. Yeah, Jason?
Well, some sense of prophecy, some...
That's all that is. That's all it is. You look through those 12 books and you will find all it is nevuah. In other words, Hosea, you have a little story at the beginning where Hashem tells Hosea to marry a woman of ill repute and have kids with her, whether it really happened or not. It seems like it did. And then in Perek Gimel, the same thing, and that's it. Yoel, there's no biography whatsoever. By the way, we also have no idea when some of these people lived. Big machloket about it. Amos is one little biographic comment about an interaction between Amos and a priest in the north. That's it. Ovadia, nothing. It's one chapter. Micha, no biography. Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, nothing there. Right? Meaning, there's no story. What it is prophecy. And you expect that. You open up a book of Nevuah and you expect, I'm going to read inspiring, frightening, exhortative, comforting, whatever words of Nevuah. The Hebrew is going to be hard, and the ideas are going to be lofty, and it's going to be poetic, and I need to figure it out. That's Nevuah. Now, I also know that there's books that we call Nevi'im, which are historiographies. And that's Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim, the first four books after the Torah. First four books of Nevuah are a history, basically going from entering the land to land to leaving the land. Okay, and I don't expect to hear much Nevuah there, and I'm satisfied that I don't hear much. I hear very little words of Nevuah in those four books. I have Yoshua, three psukim worth, in the famous Shemesh B'Givon Dom, Shoftim, besides Shirat Dvorah, really there's no Nevuah there. In Shmuel, I have here and there a couple words, a couple psukim, passages, and in Malachim, I have a little bit more, but that's it. So just like every other book in Tanakh, which is mainly one genre, but has other things mixed in, same thing there. I open up Yeshayahu, I know what to expect. Yirmiyahu, I know what to expect. The Chezkel, I know what to expect. And all these other Nevi'im, I know what to expect. And I open up Yonah, and I'm surprised, because how much of Yonah is prophetic rhetoric? Five words. That's it. The rest of it is story. What is this book doing here? So like I said, what's it doing in Tanakh? I'm going to explain. To put it with the literary Nevi'im, which is where it is, doesn't make any sense. There's no Nevuah in the book. To put it with the historiography doesn't make sense either, because it's not a historiography. If the story of Yonah was mixed somewhere in to Malachim much more briefly in the interaction with Ashur, it would be really weird, but I would get it. But as an independent work, it doesn't belong there. And to put it in with the wisdom literature, which is in Ketuvim, wouldn't fit either. So my question is really, what's it doing in Tanakh? And more critically, what's it doing in, as the title says, Ba'asufa HaNevuit, in the collection of prophecies? What's Yonah doing there? So in order to answer it, what I'd like to do is to quickly skim through the highlights of Sefer Yonah, and then take a look at a few pieces from other books in Nevi'im in order to kind of formulate a position. You take a look at the first chapter of Yonah in source 4, and you see how the sailors behave. The sailors behave with tremendous compassion for Yonah, even at risk of their own lives, and they do everything they can to get the boat back to shore, and they pray everything else until finally there's no chance. In the meantime, Yonah allows them or encourages them or almost forces their hand to throw him overboard. And he's going to die in the sea. In the middle of the Mediterranean, he's going to die. God then sends a fish to swallow him up, and he stays in the fish. And after 3 days, God has the fish spit him up on a dry land. In other words, God takes full care of Yonah, even though Yonah has been running away. We come to Nineveh, and we saw how the people reacted, right, in source 6. And so those are the highlights I want to point to. Now, what I'd like to do is to take a look here at selections from four different books of the Nevi'im that we're familiar with. And I'd like to take a premise that we worked with and turn it on its head. The premise that we assumed was that the books of prophecy are essentially about prophetic rhetoric. In other words, Yirmiyahu gets up and says, Ko amar Adonai zacharti lach chesed nurayach ahavav klotayach lechtech harachara bamibar, or, I was at a wedding yesterday, O yishama b'makom hazeh asher, right? Asher charevu me'adonai, kol sason v'kol simcha, kol chatam v'kol kalah, kol omrim hodu Adonai tzvaot, v'yiv toda beit Adonai heinu, right, etc. That's what we expect to read in Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, and the other Nevi'im. You open up Yirmiyahu, Perek, Chavzayin, source 1, 7, and source 8 together, and you see that at a particular point, God says to Yirmiyahu, I want you to make an iron yoke and put it on your back and stand up in front of the people and say, this yoke represents the subjugation of Babylonia. I have appointed Babylonia to be sovereign over this part of the world for a while. You have to accept it. Anybody who does not accept his sovereignty is going to suffer. And by the way, there's Hananiah ben Azur, a false prophet who comes and publicly breaks the yoke off of Yirmiyahu's back. Yirmiyahu is told to take this action. Second thing, source 9. Yirmiyahu is told, and this is very seasonal, Yirmiyahu is told to go down to the potter. And he says, what do you see at the potter? So I'm going to read it because it's just such a beautiful passage. I mean, anything Yirmiyahu is going to be gorgeous. Gorgeous. Pasuk bet. Kum v'yagarta beta yotzer v'shamash mi'achad dvarai. Go to the house of the potter, and I'll let you know, I'm going to give you prophecy there. Va'ered beta yotzer, I go down there. V'hine hu oseh melacha al ha'ofnayim. He's working on a potter's wheel. V'nishchata kli asher hu oseh b'chomer b'yachom b'yada yotzer. And what happens is the thing that he was making was no good. He was making a pot. It was no good. So what did he do? He broke it. V'shava yaseu kli acher kasher yashar b'yada yotzer la'asot. And he broke it and made it better. In other words, he made a pot. The pot didn't come out the way he liked. He broke it, reshaped it, and he made another one the way he wanted. And now, he'd rather my lie more. And then God spoke to me there, right? Because he told me to go to the potter. I went to the potter. I observed his behavior. God then said to me, what do you see? And I told him. And then God says, "Hachayotzer hazeh lo uchal lasot lachem beit Yisrael nu Adonai? Aren't I like this potter? Can't I do that with you? And I show this to you because kinei kachomer biyad hayotzer kein atem biyadi beit Yisrael. Just like the clay is in the potter's hand, similarly you are in my hand, beit Yisrael. Like kachomer biyad hayotzer, of course, the famous piyut that we say in Yom Kippur at night after Kol Nidre. But notice what happened here. Yirmiyahu in these two places was told to either take upon himself or observe a physical action involving a physical item. That's not the only ones in Yirmiyahu. And to interact with it in some way, and that's the prophetic message. Now take a look at Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu, because this is not unique to Yirmiyahu. In Yeshayahu Parakhaf, this is when the Assyrian incursion went as far south as Ashdod. It's mentioned several times in Yeshayahu. So Tartan is the chief of staff or the head of the army, and he comes down and conquers Ashdod. So God then spoke to Yeshayahu. What was the message? So loosen the sackcloth that you're wearing, and then take your shoes off. And Yeshayahu does it. He walks around barefoot. And Aharon, naked, well, how naked is he? He doesn't have his proper clothes on. And he's barefoot. And now, Vayomer Adonai, Kasher halach abdi Yeshayahu Aharon v'yachef. Just like my servant Yeshayahu has walked around barefoot, unclothed, shalosh shanim otum ofet, and evidently he hasn't walked around like this for 3 years as a sign. Wait, just wait for something even wilder. Al Mitzrayim ve'al Kush, this is a sign regarding Egypt and Kush, Ethiopia. Kein yinhag melech Ashur, Shvi Mitzrayim ve'et galut Kush, Na'arim, Tanim, Aron, B'yachef, Hasuf Hashir, Tervat Mitzrayim. This is what the king of Assyria is going to do to the Egyptians. But you see, Yeshayahu, that's model, that's what's going to happen to all of the Egyptians. They're going to be taken captive by the Assyrians, they'll all be taken barefoot, etc. Right? So in other words, Yeshayahu is told to behave in a certain way for a long time, and be sort of a living message of the prophecy. In Yechezkel, we have a whole host of very strange things towards the beginning of Yechezkel, where God tells Yechezkel to take a brick and carve Yerushalayim on it, and then make a little siege. Remember, Yechezkel is giving prophecy in Babel, just before the siege begins over Jerusalem. And he said, and now set up either like a PlayStation, set up a little siege around the city, right? And then put little camps around it. And then he talked about the lion on the left, on the, I don't call it, walking barefoot. Take a look at Pasuk Dalet. He says, lie on your left side, and you're going to be there for 390 days. Then turn to your right side and lie on your right side for 40 days. I'm not sure what this means, whether it means he did it for 5 minutes a day or whatever. But the point of this entire position, piece is that Yechezkel is doing all this very strange stuff, with, and that's the message. Now, what we've seen so far is Yirmiyahu with the yoke, Yirmiyahu with the potter's wheel, Yeshayahu with the barefoot, Yechezkel with the strange behaviors, are all part of the message. Hosea starts off, the beginning of Hosea in front of us, with this very strange story that I mentioned earlier, where God tells Hosea that you should take a woman of ill repute, have kids with her, call the first kid Yisrael, then call the kid Lo Ruchama, then call the kid Lo Ami, right? Because I'm not going to have compassion on the people. They're not my people anymore. Essentially, he's asking Hosea to act out the kind of relationship that Hashem has with Bnei Israel. Now, what's the point of all of these different things? Because we think that prophecy means that God inspires the prophet to say something. The prophet gets up and says something, and we hear really moving words, really scary words, really inspiring words, whatever it might be. But we have to broaden our notion of nevuah, because there's just way too many cases in the Nevi'im when what they're told to do is not speak but act. And their actions are the message. In other words, God communicates all sorts of ways. God communicates through words. God communicates through actions that people model. God communicates through his own manipulation of history. There's a lot of different ways that God communicates his message. Rolling back, what I'd like to suggest is that Sefer Yonah is not a story with five words of prophecy. You know, sometimes I speak to colleagues and I say, what are you teaching this year? Say, oh, we're teaching Megillot. What are you teaching? Well, you know, it's before Rosh Hashanah, so we teach Yonah. Then we teach Ruth and Esther. I said, since when is Yonah and a Megillah? But they think of it that way, and I understand why, because it's a story, and it's a short story, and it's a moving story, and it's got a lot of tension, and it's great to teach it. And Yonah, Ruth, and Esther really are a nice threesome in that way. But they're not related. Ruth is straight-up narrative. Esther is straight-up narrative. Yonah is straight-up nevuah. But what's the nevuah? The nevuah is not the five words. The nevuah is the story. The nevuah is the actions. When we hear about the behavior of the sailors and the way that the sailors had compassion for Yonah, and we understand that the sailors' overwhelming compassion almost got them killed, we get a message about compassion. But when we hear about Yonah running away from God and God doing everything he can to save Yonah, including giving Yonah protection under sea and then bringing him back to land, we get another message about chesed. We get another message about something else. When Yonah walks into the city and makes his declaration, and we fully expect everybody in Nineveh to throw the guy in the booby hatch and throw away the key or shoot him or something else. Instead, the people react instinctively doing the right thing, which highlights something that Rav Kook liked to refer to as Musar TV. So instinctive Musar, that people ultimately really know what the right thing is, and they understand our society has fallen apart. And if this man says in 40 days the civilization is going to be destroyed, the city is going to be destroyed, they understand what's wrong. They know what they need to do. And they know that what that need is A, to involve everybody. B, to get rid of the trappings of wealth. C, to actually fix what they've done wrong, to right the ship. And D, to call out to God and say, please, please see that we've changed and forgive us. So there's an instinctive understanding among people, as people, not Jews, among people, about what the right thing to do is. And an And in times of danger, people will rise. Sometimes people will rise to the occasion. You then come to Yonah, and Yonah is sticking to his guns. No, I want Emet, even though Yonah is only alive because of Chesed. If we're based on Emet, Yonah would be long drowned. But that's Yonah, is the message is Emet. And the ultimate message of this nevuah that comes in four chapters, three of the narrative and one poetry, is that Chesed trumps Emet. And that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ultimate interest is in keeping his people alive and doing everything possible to save his people. Now, his people writ large is humanity. His people focused in Tanakh is Am Yisrael. But the purpose of the story, again, is as a nevuah. So what we have here is a nevuah unlike other nevuot, but a nevuah nonetheless. A nevuah not of words, but a nevuah of actions. And actions here undertaken by the Navi that are the wrong actions, and actions undertaken by everybody around the Navi that are the right actions. So it's almost like if you think back to what pictures used to look like in the 20th century, it's like the negative of it. It's the other side of what the message is supposed to be. And so that's the message that we're supposed to take away from it, is that first of all, there has to be an instinctive sense. We understand. We don't need someone to spell it out for us. Od arba'im yom v'nevei nepachet should be enough for us. We shouldn't need it to be spelled out, aleph, bet, gimel, to understand what we need to do and what we need to fix it. And second of all, we need to act with abundant and overwhelming chesed towards each other, because that's ultimately the only way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can save us, is with his overwhelming chesed. And so that's the demand to us. So that is, I think, what Sefer Yonah really is all about.